take the bad job, take the risk, be willing to move your family, like do all of the things. Like if you want safe and steady, it's just probably not going to happen, right? So I always tell people, be open-minded to every opportunity that comes your way.
You're listening to Hawk Talk, a podcast all about the origin stories of the most interesting people in the world. Today, you know our guests as famous athletes, authors, and entrepreneurs. But there's so much more to the story. Let's get into today's interview with your host, Eric Huberman.
All right, you're listening to Hawk Talk. I'm here today with Kevin Demoff. How are you doing?
We're 1-2, so I'm okay, right? Like we're 1-0, now we're 1-2. So if we beat Indianapolis on Sunday, then I'll be good. Right
I'll
now,
be
I'm
watching.
Just okay.
Awesome. Well, to kick it off, I assume like the day you're born, you're probably screaming at the screen immediately in the delivery room and watching football and just a diehard fan from the start, right?
That's actually probably pretty true. My parents tell you I learned how to read by reading box scores in the newspaper.
Really?
So okay. Before really I read good. Books, I yep. would read the box score.
That's amazing.
So that was how I taught myself how to read. And they came down one day and I'm reading the newspaper at breakfast. Now, mind you, I don't read books. I'm 2 or 3 or whatever it is, but I'm sitting there reading the sports section. My parents are like, okay, this is not the usual way someone learns how to read.
What I'm curious, where'd that come from? Like, how'd you fall into caring at 2 and 3 years old about the box scores?
I have no idea, right? Like, you just kind of wired, you know, my father, you know, used to represent athletes. Now kind of represents broadcasters. And so like family was in sports, but just always a passion for it. You'd go to games, you kind of grow up. My family, had UCLA basketball season tickets. So that was the one thing we kind of did as a family. We'd go to those games at Pauley Pavilion. I'd sleep under the seats. So sports was always ingrained everywhere in our world from a pretty early age. And you just kind of fall in love with it.
Was it like, I guess, as far back as you can remember, you said, did you want to be an athlete at some point? Or was it always, I want to work in an organization? Like, what was it as a kid?
My parents will tell a great story from the 1984 Olympics. I was 7, so you don't know anything. And we had a party at our house. So my dad was working for an agency group at the time. And so we had a bunch of athletes over, including a bunch of swimmers. I think Rowdy Gaines and some others who were competing at Olympics. And then the West German national basketball team. So like Detlef Schrempf and Christian Welp and a bunch of guys. And I remember one of them brought a gold medal. I think West German team might have won a bronze. And so I said, does anybody ever won an Olympic medal in 2 sports? And they said, no. And I'm like, well, I'm definitely going to be the first, right? You know, so, awesome. You know that, but when you're 7, you think you actually can be a good athlete. Then you realize, you know, genetics probably aren't going to put you into any sport. So, you know,
what were the sports? Do you have an idea of what those 2 sports were at 7?
I started swimming actually as a result out of watching the Olympics and kind of falling in love with swimming. So I was a swimmer. I played basketball. Those are really the 2 that I loved the most as a kid. You know, basketball, you realize pretty quickly if you're 5'11", you know, that's not going to be your sport.
That'd be pretty good.
And in swimming just takes a lot more dedication than I actually have to get up at 5 a.m. and go do the workouts and really do it. And I actually came to quickly understand that I like team sports a lot better than individual sports. That was one of my struggles with swimming, which was like, you know, just love being part of a team and competing and winning as a team. And swimming was way too individual for me. So pretty quickly realized that if I wanted to be in sports, it had to be something aside from athlete. I always thought I'd become a broadcaster. Like okay. That was my dream, was like, go become a sports broadcaster or do something like that. And
when did that
didn't materialize out?
When did because funnily enough, I had a similar shift on the music side. I thought I was going to be a rock star and a guitarist all from 4 years old till about 12 when I realized it just wasn't that good. And so then it became, I want to be a music manager and be in the music business. So was it like a shift like around that age where you're like, oh, maybe I'm not keeping up, or when did that happen?
You know, it was, I mean, actually, no, like I kind of did it all, you know, I would pretend, you know, I'd go to games and have a pen in front of me and pretend I was calling the game or, you know, do whatever, you know, kind of covered sports throughout high school. I was the editor of the newspaper, sports editor. I went to college and was the sports editor of the newspaper, and I covered basketball, hockey, soccer, women's lacrosse, baseball. I broadcast all those games. So like I did that all. I think it was in college when you realize like, okay, maybe there are people who are a lot better at this than I am. Like nobody's hearing my tapes, you know, on WDCR in Lebanon, New Hampshire and saying, oh, you should be, you know, the next Stuart Scott, right? Like that was probably when you realize, okay, maybe no one's come calling. I'm not sure that I'm, you know, and that path is so hard. And I've had friends who have done it. You know, you go become the broadcaster in Davenport, Iowa, you know, the backup weekend anchor, like it just, that path seemed pretty hard. Although one of my first internships ever, either sports or non-sports, I was a kind of a gopher for what back at the time was the Mighty 690 Radio, which used to be in LA and San Diego. And they opened up a studio in basically in Woodland Hills. And so I'd go in there and I did the night show from 9 to midnight at first. And then I was with a guy named Rick Schwartz. And then we went, okay, we got moved to the morning show from like 5 to 9. And I don't know which was worse. You know, as a high schooler, like 9 to midnight kind of sucked because you lost your nights like in the summer and you're like, I'm not cool. 5 to 9, you know, getting up at 4 a.m. in the summer, you know, it was brutal. Although at 9 o'clock, you were done with the day. So you're like, okay, like this is a pretty good life. So, you know, I always thought there was a chance radio or TV, but it just never materialized. And probably a face for radio and a voice for, you know, podcasts.
Touche. And what did you study in school when you went to college?
Yeah, so I was a history major and essentially an art history minor, but my focal study, my senior thesis was on women's reading and writing habits in Quaker colonial Philadelphia, which is really applicable to the business of sports and, you know, and what we do now. So if you want to talk about, you know, friends, libraries, and, you know, the books that got borrowed in 1783, I'm your man.
There you go. And it's carried through your whole career, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I always tell people now when they ask, like, what should I major in if I want to work in sport? I'm like, major whatever you want. Like, it really doesn't matter. And I was kind of an art history minor. I loved architecture, which probably wound up serving me well when we did SoFi Stadium. But, you know, that was really what I did. I was not did not study any sports or business at all in college.
And so did you go right into the sports industry right out of college? Or what was the first step after that?
Yeah, kind of. So I, in college, kind of continuing the theme, I worked at NBC Sports when I thought I'd go into sports TV. And I applied for jobs at CBS and NBC and HBO Sports and all of these. And they all basically wound up being minimum wage in New York. And I think I looked and I said, how do you live in, you know, New York City on, you know, minimum wage and work the hours you want? So I actually wound up getting a job offer back here in Los Angeles with a guy who was starting a company called Broadband Sports, which was probably 10 to 15 years out of its time. If you take what is now Bleacher Report, SB Nation, we actually owned Roto World at the time. We did athlete websites, kind of like the Players Tribune. It was a real mishmash of that. And it was a startup. So when, you know, I did what everybody else did in 1999, I went to work for the internet. When I went to Broadband Sports, I think I was like the 30th employee there. When I left 9 months later, there were 300 employees.
Wow.
9 months after that, they were out of business. You know, we went through the whole cycle. We were going to have an IPO. We all had stock. We moved to fancy offices in Santa Monica. You know, we did it all. Like, looking back, it was a great experience because, you know, you can say you were part of a rocket ship that kind of went up and down. And, you know, when I left 9 months in, you could kind of see, you know, the cracks. But, you know, it was funny having not studied business at all. Like, there were all these things I thought that were wrong, but, you know, what do I know? I'm a 22-year-old history major.
Yeah.
You know, who am I to tell all these, you know, business school MBA grads? And I mean, they were pulling an amazing talent from Disney and Paramount, all these places. Like, they didn't know what they were doing. Turned out, you know, they didn't know what they were doing probably. We were probably ahead of our time. And I had no idea what I was doing, but, you know, we were all there. And it's amazing that there was actually a great group of talent there, you know, that they had assembled. And a great lesson that a great idea, you actually need time the world right. You need the right leadership. You need the right people. You know, it's not just having the best idea. Everything kind of needs to work.
Yeah. And so did you leave because you saw the writing on the wall, or what? Why? Like, that's a short stint as well.
A little bit of both. Kind of saw the writing on the wall. I remember we went into, I've been working on this project this will date me, but back then, you know, we were looking at the start of the internet. ESPN had team pages. So if you went to like the Los Angeles Ram and you click the same way there is now. And, you know, so we did this. So from what I remember, AOL had approached the company and been like, hey, we want you to kind of populate our team pages with all of your information. So then we went to this big company announcement and they said, you know, hey, we're going to do, and I'd worked on this project for a while. I was really excited. know, AOL is going to partner with us. We're going to provide all the information. I remember walking out and saying, oh, what's AOL going to pay us? And I think the person told me like, oh no, we're paying them like $15 million a year to give them the information. I'm like, look, I don't know a ton about business, but we're doing the work and we're paying them. And like, oh, you don't get it. We're going to sell advertising and merchandise and this and that. I'm like, you know, you're right. I don't get it. And at the time, so I was actually, the other project I was working on, we were building, at the time, teams didn't have websites. So the Cowboys had actually been an investor and we were building them their first ever website. So I spent about 4 months helping build the Dallas Cowboys website. And out of that, we got a ton of offers. The Dolphins, Packers, a bunch of people wanted us to build them websites. Now, mind you, by the way, we were building them websites and paying them for the right to do it. Again, probably not the best business model. And I was starting to be a little bit doubtful about the path forward for the company. And I actually got a call from Casey Wasserman, July 4th weekend. And I just assumed he was calling because someone had said, hey, will you go? He had just started an arena football team here in LA, the LA Avengers. They played at Staples Center. And I figured he was calling about doing that. And he's like, hey, heard your name through the grapevine. You know, we're starting a team and everybody says you could be really helpful on the football side. You kind of know it inside out. Would you have breakfast with me?
How old were you at that point?
I was 23.
So how did you have a reputation of knowing a lot about football and being helpful with a new team?
A lot of it came from, you know, again, I was the son of an agent, so people kind of knew that. But mainly, like, we had been building these websites, so I would fly around to Dallas, to Miami. And actually, there was a person at the Raiders who had recommended me. We had pitched the Raiders. And I think Casey had called the Raiders asking them for, you know, potential names and within their own building who were young. And I think he gave them my name. And so we went to breakfast and he was, you know, at the time, probably mid-20s. I mean, so.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, he was like, hey, you want to come help run an arena football team? And I said, that seems great. Crazy, but great. And so I took a leap of faith and went and did that. Had no clue what I was doing. Got to make a ton of mistakes. But, you know, it was great to learn. And I would say, you know, the job's not that different than the one I have today. It's just a lot more eyeballs and a lot more zeros. But, you know, it was awesome. I got to, you know, help hire a head coach, make trades, sign players. I also picked up Chipotle every day. I took the dry cleaning to the laundromat. You know, I had to go check everybody in at the airport ahead of the, you know, commercial flight. Like, you laid t-shirts at Staples Center for fans. Like, you got to do everything. And I always say my one thing coming out of that, my advice to people always in sports, like, go work in the minor leagues because you will get to do so much.
And, yeah, it's so much a startup version where you really get to learn how everything's made.
And there are not a lot of jobs now at the Rams that I haven't done at some point in my life, mainly because of my 4 years in the Arena Football League. And Casey was an amazing mentor, an amazing boss. And that was really where I got my start in team sports and forever grateful. We won a bunch of games, not enough, but it was pretty fun.
That's awesome. And what was your official position there? Like, was there a title?
I was director of football operations. So it was kind of essentially the GM.
Yeah. And so you said you were there 4 years. So you hit about 27, have decent experience by 27 in the space. Like, there's probably very few people that even have your level. What happened next?
So, you know, kind of did 4 years in the Arena League. And it was funny, the Arena League, very similar to broadband sports. When I got there, all of a sudden NFL teams were starting to buy in. So actually the Cowboys had bought a team. The Falcons had bought a team. Bon Jovi had bought a team that was part of Philadelphia that was kind of partners with the Eagles. There were a couple of, I mean, John Elway had bought a team in Denver that actually Stan Kroenke was a minority partner in. So all these NFL teams were buying in, and every Arena League went from being on nothing to NBC was showing games on Sunday, and franchise values had gone from, I think Casey probably bought in, you know, million to million. They were selling for 16, 17 million. And again, it was this rocket ship. And I remember in 2003, we lost in the playoffs to the Denver team, the Colorado Crush, who eventually went on to win the Arena Bowl that year. And I think, if I remember correctly, like, they played in the Pepsi Center. They had John Elway was the owner. They won the title. They had the Broncos season ticket list. They had all these things going for them. And I think they still didn't make money. I remember asking someone, like, I'm like, if John Elway owning a team in Denver and winning the title can't make money, how do any of us make money?
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a little bit this eye opener. I was at this crossroads for the second time. And know, so like, so I was starting to think about leaving, and, you know, now I'm like, maybe I should go to business school, because this is the second time I've kind of been in a place where everybody in the world thinks this thing is a, you know, gold mine, and I'm on the inside and I'm like, I don't get it. I'm like, but what do I know? I'm a history major. And I remember actually we played a game. I think we were 4-0. I think the Georgia Force, which was the team the Falcons owned, were 4-0. It was a really good game. Two best teams in the league at the time. And if you remember arena football, 50-yard field indoors, huge nets behind the end zone. And so when you kicked off, anytime the ball went off the net, it was a live ball. So the game was tied like 28-all with like a minute and a half left. We score a touchdown to go ahead 35-28 with a minute left. We then proceed to kick four straight balls off the net, recover them all for touchdowns. I think we won the game 70-28. It was a Broncos-Dolphins kind of score. And I remember everybody's walking in the locker room. We're high-fiving, and I'm on the bus. I'm like, this is not real sports. Like,
yeah,
you know, this was a great game, and through some gimmick, we just won by 40 points when it was close. I'm like, I got to go. Like, I think I've maxed out here. And so I applied to business school, kind of figuring, you know, that would be the next path to kind of go, you know, improve, want to go into business school for 2 years. And then right before I went to business school, I got a call from my friend who had actually the person who had recommended me at the Raiders. He had just taken a job as the GM of the Buccaneers. And he's like, would you come to Tampa with me? And I was like, you know, I really think I should go to business school. I need to learn, like I need to differentiate myself. And he's like, great, you can work for free for me for 2 years interning during business school, and then you can kind of come here. And so that's basically what I did. Went back to business school for 2 years, interned for the Buccaneers for 2 years, and joined them full-time after business school.
Awesome. Got it. So I'm curious, because that was such a key connection for you, the guy at the Raiders. Was that just, did you build the website for the Raiders, or did you just meet him through?
You know, I don't think we actually wound up, there was a guy, I remember it was Bruce Allen, who was the GM of the Raiders, who went to become GM of the Buccaneers, who then went to Washington. I don't think we wound up building the website, partly because the company eventually folded. But, you know, apparently that pitch was pretty good, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say, was it like, did you actually have a real relationship with him? Or was it literally you pitched him, and when he was asked by Casey Wasserman, who should I talk to? He's like, I remember this kid that was great. Like,
I mean, look, I've never asked, like, I mean, he had known my father, like I never really known Bruce, but like when we pitched, I think it was just like, hey, here's someone who you should chat with. And then, you know, once I was in the Arena League, someone who kind of became a mentor and, you know, walked me through and kind of had followed my career at each point. So I don't know whether it was the pitch or, you know, the last name or all of it or something in between.
One, I mean, I have it with my, I'm sure you do too. Like when a YPOer recommends their kid or their a YPOer's kid to come work with you, like there's something about knowing the parent or at least knowing the parent's background and that the kid grew up around a hustle mentality or work ethic. It kind of checks a few boxes that makes you more comfortable probably too. So if they, I think that relationship probably did help, but that makes sense.
Look, and I think for me, it was like, hey, the Arena League was a great place to be a proving ground. And it was great to have someone kind of recommend you, but not to work for them. So they could then judge from afar whether you were worth a damn or not. Right. Yeah. Like, yep. You know, it's okay. Like I'll recommend you. Hopefully it works out, you know, and you always hope when you recommend someone and someone hires them that it does, you know, but I was just like anybody who has success in life, you had people who push for you
100%,
you know, behind the scenes, in front of the scenes. And we're all here because someone believes in us at some point, you know, to give us that first opportunity, that first crack. And for me, you know, Bruce did it, but Casey was the one who actually had to take the leap of faith, you know, and hire me. And, you know, so, but it's been fun coming back here and actually reconnecting and working with him here.
Yeah. And so how long were you got out of school? How long were you in the Bucs after school?
I was in the Bucs from 2006 to 2009.
Okay.
So including three full seasons in Tampa, but really five seasons kind of with the Buccaneers total.
Okay. Got it. And what caused you to leave there, like after that experience?
Yeah. So kind of by the end of year three, you know, I went to business school and I always had this thought like, hey, maybe my goal was within 5 to 7 years of leaving business school to become a GM. You know, then you'd be GM for 5 to 7 years and hopefully become a team president. And that was kind of what I always thought. You know, if you were lucky, there were a few people who had blazed that path, and that was kind of the timeline. And so, you know, I got to, you know, we're in Tampa. We started winning a bunch of games. I was there with John Gruden and Bruce Allen. You know, team is pretty good. And, you know, we started getting the end of year three and you start to think, okay, I'm now 30, 31, still very young, but like, you know, maybe your name's in the mix, you know, kind of in the media for like a rising GM job or this or that. And, you know, so you start to think about it. And I actually got a call from the Rams. So it's late 2008, probably December 2008. And Georgia Frontier, who had owned the team, had just passed away. So Chip Rosenblum, Lucia Rodriguez, two kids, took over the team. And John Shaw, who was the longtime president of the Rams, was retiring. The head coach was going to leave. The GM was going to leave. So they're kind of going through a complete rebuild. And they were planning on promoting somebody who was like their head of personnel internally to the GM, but they needed someone who understood the salary cap, who understood player negotiations, kind of understood the finance part. And so they're a little bit like, well, would you come as like a co-GM was kind of the pitch. And I said, you know, I really have no interest. I have a great job here in Tampa. But if you let me, I know your president just left. If you let me interview to replace the president, like, sure, I'll interview. What do I have to lose? And
yeah,
I just put it out there, like fully expected them to say no, no way. They said, sure, come fly out to LA and interview. So I sat with Chip and Lucia and I kind of pitched them on what I thought a vision would be. And look, the job was terrible. The team had gone 2-14 in 2008. They'd gone 3-13 in 2007. It was likely to be sold, you know, at some point in the near future. That was kind of, there was an estate tax issue and they were very upfront that they weren't sure they were going to keep the team long-term. You know, the building had a lease issue. It's a smaller market. Like everything said, this is a terrible job.
Yeah.
But I've always been a believer. Like I kind of looked in and said, well, if you can turn that team around, then you can really punch your ticket in and do anything. And so like you shoot your shot and, you know, you see what happens. I'm sure no one good wanted the job. They wanted someone really cheap and fungible, I think, because if the team got sold, person probably get fired, new owner would have to inherit the contract, like all these reasons. And I'm sure they probably talked to 30, 50 people before me and they're like, no way, no way. And here I am 31 being like, yeah, let's go. I'm gung-ho, you know, but I figure it's got to be a pretty decent offer to leave Tampa. We're potentially playoff bound, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we were 9-3 in Tampa that year. We lost our final four games. We were became the first 9-3 team in the history of the NFL to miss the playoffs. And, you know, and I'm still, you know, I have a good life. I'm happy. My wife is 9 months pregnant with our second kid. Like, life is great.
You're living,
you know,
in Tampa, which is not so bad, too.
Living in Tampa, and, yeah, you know, we're happy. And I actually get called and get offered the job Friday afternoon. Rams call and say, hey, you're good. And I'm like, all right, well, let me think about it. And that was the same day John Gruden and Bruce Allen got fired in Tampa.
Oh, wow.
So all of a sudden, then one of my closest friends in the front office becomes the GM. Raheem Morris, who's now our defensive coordinator of the Rams, becomes head coach, who was our, you know, DB coach there. And all of a sudden, there's this huge transition. And now you're probably needed as much as ever in Tampa. Like they had offered for me to stay. You had this opportunity in St. Louis, and it was a really hard decision. But in the end, I said, you know, let me go take the new opportunity, see what's what. And that's how I wound up with the Rams. And I fully no idea of what I was getting into.
Yeah. And that was 2009.
And I believe, you know, I told her, it was like, what do you think? I'm like, look, they went 3-13, 2-14. You know, there's nowhere to go but up. And then we promptly went 1-15. So, you know, I always tell people now, when you take a job and you say there's nowhere to go but up, like in the NFL, you better be 0-17.
Yeah.
If you say that, because there's always worse you could do. And I don't think I had any real idea of how troubled the franchise actually was at the time, but it's been an amazing journey. And here we sit. This is the start of my 15th season later, which is just, it's hard to actually believe. And it was pretty interesting. We opened the season this year in Seattle, and my first game ever with the Rams in 2009, we opened in Seattle. So it kind of was like this moment of this first time we had opened in Seattle in 15 years since. And kind of was riding on the bus to the stadium and thinking like, well, you know, we've done some good things. We've done some bad things in 15 years, but what an amazing journey it's been.
Yeah. And you got to bring it back to LA and win a Super Bowl in the first year in their new stadium that you helped put together. So actually going through that, at what point did the Kroenkes come in and buy the team? How long were you with the owners?
So Stan Kroenke, when I joined the Rams, Chip and Lucia and their family owned 60% and Stan owned the other 40%. So they put the team up for sale in 2009, as they said they would. A lot of potential buyers came in, but Stan had a matching right to any offer. And so eventually Shad Khan, who now owns the Jacksonville Jaguars, put in an offer in February of 2010 to buy the Rams. Stan had 60 days to match. And I had met him a couple of times during the previous year. And so he wound up matching, you know, keeping the team. He got approved, I think, in August of 2010. You know, and I always joke, like, you know, because he got the team in August, you kind of knew, like, okay, he's not going to make a ton of changes in 2010. But I don't know if you remember in The Princess Bride, you know, the character's always like, the Dread Pirate Roberts, like, well, today was a good day, I might kill you tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I always felt like when you worked, like when Stan took over, it's like, well, today was a good day, I might get fired tomorrow. Like, yeah. I might get fired tomorrow. And after 15 years of saying that, you kind of wonder, like, okay, you still feel that way to some degree, not because of him at all, but you just, you go through with that mentality. And, you know, then 2010, you know, we actually had a pretty good year. We were 7-8. We lost in the final game and missed the playoffs. Sam Bradford's rookie of the year. You know, then the next year is kind of the lockout, so you're not making a lot of changes. And it felt like just one thing kind of led to another. We wound up building a relationship and, you know, just fortunate to, you know, hopefully gain his trust and keep going.
And so when did you start, I mean, being in St. Louis, being from LA, when did the discussion about going to LA start to come up?
Yeah, so when I took the job, you know, St. Louis had a lease issue. So basically, there was a clause in the lease, and when the team moved from Los Angeles to St. Louis, it said every 10 years, the stadium in St. Louis had to be one of the top 8 stadiums in the NFL. And so in 1995 to 2005, and they kind of waived this provision in 2005, and in 2005, they put together a process through arbitration by which you would determine it the next time. So that arbitration was in 2012. And basically what the arbitration was, the Rams would present what they thought would make the stadium top 8. The city would present what they thought would make the stadium top 8. And then if we didn't agree, a panel of arbitrators would decide. We put together a plan at the time that was $700 million. The city put together a plan that was $120 million, roughly. Arbitrators ruled in favor of the Rams plan. And so then the city had a choice, which was either they could enact the changes for $720 million, or basically they could, our lease reverted to a year-to-year lease, which meant it ceased to, you know, function. So the city basically told us they weren't going to make the changes in July of 2013, which essentially meant we had a year left on our lease and we were then free agents. And not only were they not going to make the changes, but really they didn't have interest in doing very much more. And yeah, you know, I would say if there's one thing you shouldn't tell a real estate developer, it's basically that your lease is expiring, you don't have any options.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, someone who's entrepreneurial. And, you know, ultimately that coincided with Hollywood Park kind of becoming available as a property. So, you know, for Stan, who's one of the world's preeminent real estate developers and one of the preeminent sports owners, it was really a chance, you know, to put those two together, return the team to Los Angeles. And look, if you Google my name in St. Louis, it's not a good yeah, search.
That's how it goes.
And look, it was a bruising couple of years to kind of go through the process. You know, St. Louis tried to jump in, you know, much after the game and build a stadium. And, you know, and then the Chargers and Raiders tried to build a competing project in Carson. You know, it was a really difficult 2.5 years. But ultimately, January 2016, we won the right to come back. You know, people would always say, like, you know, did you go to the Rams? I'm like, I had no clue when I went to the Rams that any of this would ever happen, you know. Team, you know, yeah, you figure the team gets sold, but, you know, you get a new owner, you build a new stadium in St. Louis, you stay there. Like, you're just trying to do the best job you can. You
know, I am curious. St. Louis,
obviously.
On that note, did you think you might be just in St. Louis? Because, like, what's the step after president of an organization? Like, you're already the president of the Rams. What did you have a vision of, like, what could have been next if it didn't progress? Or?
You know, I always thought, like, you know, hey, maybe if I do a good job here, I can go back to Tampa, right? Like, or, you know, yeah, maybe you go to a bigger market or something happens. Yeah. But look, like, your job is to go make the team as good as possible, right? And you know, I never thought about what was next. I always thought about, we can't fail because, you know, you just, this is your career. And if you fail, you probably don't get another shot.
Yeah.
Right. And so,
yeah, because it sounds like
it was always,
because the rest of your career
is more downside risk.
Yeah. And the rest of your career sounded like stepping stones, that president role, like, you had arrived in your head. And so then it was just like, now deliver.
It, you know, it was really interesting when I was in Tampa and I was around so many talented scouts who were really good at their job and talented personnel people. And I realized, you know what? I won't be as good of a GM as these people, right? Like, they truly know the game better. They've scouted it better. You know, my skill set is not a great match for being a GM. You know, I do understand the business of football, but I also kind of understand the bigger picture and how it comes together. And so I realized pretty quickly that I'd rather be a, you know, president than a GM if I had the choice. Now, I always figured the path would be you had to become a GM and become a president. When I got the chance at the Rams, one of the unique things was, okay, you could go skip the step, you know, and become president. So, you know, now you had, you know, a dream job. You're president of an NFL team, you know, whether it's the best team or the worst team, you're still in the NFL running a team, and loved every second of it. And, you know, really enjoy the challenge of trying to turn it around in St. Louis. I mean, we actually made a bunch of, you know, we never kind of broke through and had that winning season. And look, anytime you move a team, it's a referendum on, you know, what happened. Like, we didn't do a good enough job to have success, which, you know, which is one of the reasons the team moved. I mean, LA is a little bit of a different opportunity, but for the most time when a team moves, it's because you failed previously somewhere else for a lot of different reasons. You know, so you always figure like, hey, I just want to go be successful here and make this team successful. And, you know, maybe you get a job, you know, at a big market, you're at the Bears or the Giants or the Niners at that time. But the idea like, oh, you're going to bring the NFL back to Los Angeles. Like, you know, so many people had failed, you know, Michael Eisner and, you know, Michael Ovitz and Marvin Davis and Casey taking a stab, potentially getting the same, like, so many great people in Los Angeles had tried to bring a team back and failed. Like, you're not sitting there thinking like, oh, this is going to happen. And, you know, kind of when it did, you kind of look at it from a Rams perspective, like, okay, this is a chance to go build the world's greatest stadium and one of the world's greatest markets and, you know, truly bring the NFL back to Los Angeles. Like, it's a great challenge, but it wasn't one that you're like, you sat out in your career and like, oh, I want to be part of the group that brings the NFL back to Los Angeles. Like, very serendipitous. You wound up right place, right time.
Yeah. And that's awesome. And so how was the process of like building out that stadium? And like you said, there were a couple years that it was tough and then it started to really ramp up. Like, the actual process of moving out here, how was that experience? Because you didn't have a real estate development background. I know Stan obviously does, but you got thrown into it as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, we were fortunate. This team doesn't move back to Los Angeles. We had great partners along the way, whether it was our architects at HKS or Wilson Meany, who had owned and kind of really were running the land in Hollywood Park because it was going to be a mixed use development. You know, we bought it. Stockbridge was the private equity group that owned Hollywood Park. We jumped right in. We had a great partnership with the Inglewood City Council, Mayor Butts. You know, everything went right. I mean, we just got, you know, break after break. You know, there was a Supreme Court ruling in California that allowed us to do a citizens initiative instead of, you know, going through a long CEQA process, you know, and that meant that someone like AEG, who was trying to build Farmers Field at the time, couldn't really stop you through the environmental process, which clearly would have happened. I truly think if that exemption hadn't existed, we still might be trying to talk about how to get a stadium in Los Angeles. The fact that, you know, the land came available, we were able to buy it, that, you know, quite frankly, no one had come back to Los Angeles in the 21 years, which I still kind of find amazing. But I think it truly took someone like Stan, who was both a, you know, savvy teen owner and savvy real estate person, to figure out how you do it. And, you know, the one thing he always said, and this was kind of the guiding principle, was you can't undershoot Los Angeles. This is a sports and entertainment capital of the world. Like, this stadium has to be amazing. Hollywood Park has to be amazing. And so really when we sat down with HKS, who at the time had designed the Cowboy Stadium, which became AT&T Stadium, they designed Lucas Oil in Indianapolis, which was great. They designed US Bank Stadium in Minnesota, which was awesome. Like, it was really, okay, how do we go design the world's greatest building? We all kind of tag teamed it together. And what's amazing is what you see at SoFi now was probably after 2 months, we kind of quickly fell upon this idea of what's so like the original design of SoFi only took about 2 months to kind of figure out. And once we saw it, we're like, that's it. That's the building. And it's amazing still walking through this day. I'll get deja vu of walking through a space now a decade later that you had seen in a rendering or had been kicked around in a conference room. And you're like, every now and then you're still like, holy crap, we actually built this thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's the most expensive stadium ever built, right?
I hope not. I hope someday someone passes us. But
so far.
Yeah, but yeah. I think we'll own the record for a while. I'll say that.
Yeah. It's going to have to be an interesting market that decides to. I mean, again, Los Angeles can justify that. There's not many markets that you can just go do that. And so a couple more questions for you. Number one, what's next? Like, how do you see sort of the advancement now that you're here? You've had a few years in there. You had a Super Bowl hosted there as well as win. And I was lucky enough to be there. Like, what do you kind of, how are you thinking about the future coming down the line?
I think it's really twofold, right? You know, you're fortunate to have had these great experiences. You're never going to top opening a stadium in your first year in your hometown, hosting a Super Bowl, winning that Super Bowl in that stadium the first year it's open. Like, in the seminal moments of your career, nothing will top that, right? Like, and I still remember, you know, standing on the podium, kind of looking around, being like, this is, you know, if this were a Hollywood script, no one would believe it, right? Like, you come back. Obviously, the stadium had opened the year before COVID, so it was the first year with fans. First year with fans, your stadium's open. You know, you host a Super Bowl in it, and you win that Super Bowl. You know, like, there's no way that makes any sense. And, you know, but I think for the NFL being gone 21 years, it's such a long path to get back to where, you know, we should be as an organization. So for me, people mention us in the same breath as the Lakers and the Dodgers, but like, we've got to continue to work to kind of earn that. You know, I want to be one of the 10, you know, this team should be one of the 10 biggest sports brands in the world, up there with, you know, Lakers, Cowboys, Yankees, Arsenal, Barcelona, Man U. Like, that's where this team should be. That's the mission you go to work with every day. And, you know, while we've done amazing leaps and bounds, like, we're not at that pantheon yet. So really, that's, you know, that's step number one. And then step number two is, you know, growing the talent within the building. You know, I really hope that the person who takes over the Rams, you know, and takes it to the next level is someone who is in the building right now and can go do that and, you know, take it to the next step. And it really, at this point, it's as much about mentorship and the next generation and developing that talent and seeing those people grow. Now, I think those are the two challenges left in the NFL. Look, you want to go compete and win a Super Bowl every year. You know, you're someone, if you sign up to work in sports, you're somewhat of a masochist. You know, one out of 32 teams in our league goes home happy. You know, we're fortunate enough to have won a Super Bowl. Fortunate enough to have been in a Super Bowl, but ultimately lost. You know, there's the hollow feeling when you wake up the next day and you're like, wow, like, that we did all that work and came up empty handed. Nobody remembers the Super Bowl loser. No one remembers the team who lost in the divisional round. Like, you were in a job where you either win the Super Bowl or you don't. You know, once you're fortunate enough to bend to one, let alone win one, you realize how hard it is, how lucky you have to be. Everything has to break your way just to have a chance to go compete. It's why I have such admiration for the Patriots. I mean, to go to 9 Super Bowls, I think, in 20 years is just ridiculous. I mean, you know, to win 6 of them, and, you know, you look at a team as, you know, great as the Chiefs have been, you know, they've won 2, you know, in the past 6 years. The 49ers have, you know, obviously been awesome. They haven't won. I mean, you look at, I think the Patriots ruined, you know, the Packers had Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers for 30 years and won 1 Super Bowl.
Well, yeah.
Two Super Bowls. I'm sorry. 2, you know, in that time. But like, that is insane, right? I mean, like, when you actually think about just how hard it is to actually go do, you know, but I think ingraining this team within Los Angeles, making sure SoFi Stadium is the world's greatest stadium, whether it's hosting the World Cup, hope getting into the Super Bowl, you know, we're home to the opening closing ceremonies in 2028, you know, for the Olympics. So, you know, it's making sure the stadium lives up to that, the team lives up to that. And I think, you know, I'll probably be 50 right around when the Olympics come. And I think that's the right point to say, you know, we've checked every box here. Hopefully all of it goes well. Hopefully we've got another Super Bowl ring and Lombardi Trophy. And, you know, by then it's time to go hand it to someone else.
Nice. Got it. And one little follow-up on that. In terms of building a fan base, like you mentioned the Lakers, the, you know, the Yankees, these kind of places, it seems like a lot of that is like, I grew up with this as a kid. So does part of your calculation go like 30 years from now and we're still here, that will be when we hit? Or are you looking at ways to try to accelerate that in some way?
It's both. I mean, I would tell you one of our key focus points right now is kids, right? The kids who grow up, yeah, because that's when you develop your fandom and, you know, you start, you know, one of the challenges of coming back to Los Angeles was you know, the NFL had such success here. You could still watch Sunday Ticket. You could still play fantasy football. You got the best games on Fox and CBS, NBC and ESPN every week. Like, you didn't need, like, Los Angeles was the proof that you didn't need a team in your city to actually be a good NFL market, right? And so then the Rams come back, which was awesome. But, you know, you get to this point where, you know, everybody who had grown up here for a generation had grown up rooting for another team. You know, people who had moved here from other cities from 1995 to 2016, you know, if you're from Pittsburgh, you're still a Steelers fan because there was no team to root for. And I think, you know, it's like LA has a bar for every team.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, if you're a Browns fan, there's a Browns bar. If you're a Vikings fan, there's a Vikings bar. And like people have their rituals. So, you know, it's one thing to convince people to start to root for the Rams, right? Okay. Instead of watching, you know, the game that's on CBS, I'll watch the Rams game that's on Fox. Then you've got to convince people now, okay, you used to spend all your, even if you're a diehard football fan, you spend all your Sundays on the couch watching your fantasy team. Now you're going to spend 7 hours coming to the game, tailgating, going to the game, going home, right? That's your new Sunday. You know, changing those habits is really hard. And, you know, especially when someone, you know, identifying. So one of the things, and I still remember one of my best friends here, he grew up in Chicago. You know, we actually worked together at Broadband Sports in 2000. And, you know, so when the team comes back, we're playing the Bears. He's got sideline passes and everybody but his son is wearing Bears gear. And his son's wearing a Todd Gurley jersey. It's 2018. And I'm like, that's LA in a nutshell, right? Like, this is one of my best friends. He's a season ticket holder to the Rams. And the Bears show up and he's wearing his Bears jersey, right? And like, by the way, I had no issue with it. But his son was all in on the Rams, right? And I think that was our mentality of, hey, we're going to go be your kid's favorite team. And we're going to hope we become your second favorite team. You know, and that's how we develop fandom. But long term, 20, 30 years from now, those kids become you and me.
Yeah.
They buy season tickets. They do all that. And, you know, that to me is, you know, that's a long trip play. But in the meantime, those kids right now aren't buying tickets and jerseys. So you've got to figure out a way that you thread the needle, that you make it so that this is also Los Angeles' team right now. We were very fortunate. We, you know, we had a very passionate group of fans who never left the Rams through the journey to St. Louis, you know, and back. But what people kind of forget is, you know, yes, the Rams left in 1995, but they left Anaheim in 1995. They really left Greater Los Angeles in 1979 when they went to Anaheim Stadium. You know, so you'll talk to people and they'll talk about their memories in the Coliseum. You'll talk to a bunch of fans who grew up in Orange County who talked about their memories at Anaheim Stadium, kind of weaving that tapestry back and how you push a brand forward. You're not just bringing back the 1982 Los Angeles Rams, right? You are bringing back the 2016 Rams, the 2023 Rams. You know, you're moving into the world's most modern building. How do you take what people love, you know, and try to build it for a modern stadium, a modern era? And, you know, when sports is something people have a ton of nostalgia for, and that's a fine line, you know, to walk all the time. We have a great marketing team, Kat Frederick and, you know, her team. But, you know, at the end of the day, the push-pull is, you know, what is tradition? What is new? And how do you meld the two and go from there?
Yep. That makes sense. And so last question for you, what would be your advice to someone trying to pursue their dream? Like you, it's crazy to hear that like there was a thread all the way from when you're as young as can be all the way to now in terms of what your dreams were. But let's say that whenever that comes up for someone that wants to pursue it, what's advice that you either did get or wish you got along the way that helped you just go for it like this?
There are two things I would say. And one is you have to leave your comfort zone. Like the right move when I was in Tampa was to stay in Tampa. You know, let my 9-month pregnant wife stay in Tampa, not add all this stress, you know, not pick up and move, not take the crazy job that you were pretty certain wouldn't work, but you go take a risk, right? And I think, you know, in your career, you know, at the times when you take a risk, nothing is ever linear, right? Like you can look back on your career and say like, oh, it all makes sense. It's kind of a straight arc. It is. But when you're in the moment, there are left turns, there are detours, you hit reverse, you go forward. Like I always tell people, don't plan your next step because it is almost inevitable. What you think is your next step is not your next step. And it makes you not open to the way the universe is actually shaping your career, right? So like take the bad job, take the risk, be willing to move your family, like do all of the things. Like if you want safe and steady, it's just probably not going to happen, right? So I always tell people, be open-minded to every opportunity that comes your way. But I also think one of the hard parts, and this will sound counterintuitive, I don't think people have enough patience right now. You know, I think if you look at people who are coming out of the workforce, it's like, oh, I want to work for 2 years, then I want to move a step up. And look, I'm also not advocating that you need to go back to the 50s and 60s where you work for one company for 40 years. But I think people chase incremental growth at different companies and in different places and different jobs rather than putting in the hard work to push through to meaningful growth. And so my advice to, you know, even people at the Rams, I'm like, your next job should be one you think you can't actually do, that you're scared of waking up. And like, when someone actually tells you the job, you're like, wait, can I really do that? Like, there's got to be a part of you that's scared that you won't be able to do that. If you're not scared, it's not a big enough leap for you to actually go take, you know? And so that's where I always tell people, be patient enough and earn your stripes so that when you're ready to take that jump, you jump four steps, not one, right? Like, and that way you build credibility, you build mentor, like you build your network and you do all of that. But when you take that job, like, you should be like, oh, this is the job I really want. I don't want to go from being a manager. Like, try to go from being a manager to a VP, you know, build your credibility, but then and go somewhere small, go somewhere different. Like, don't chase the brand name, chase the best experience. Like, I always tell people on your resume, it's fine that I can look at where you worked, right? But when I interview you, when I sit with you, I want to hear what you did, right? Like, I want to know what you learned and what you did and what you championed. Not that you had the brand halo, but then what did you actually learn and do? Because I'm hiring you for you. I don't get to bring the brand that's on your resume. And so I always think, like, people should be willing to take the job that's more hands-on, maybe pays less, like, you know, all these things. Like, go build your career brick by brick, put in the work, be patient. And when you see an opportunity, go after it hard. But don't just think like, oh, I'm going to stair step it up, because I just don't think that happens.
No, we see that same thing like all the time, where people like take that incremental, you know, pay raise, whatever, and leave their company, didn't spend enough time to learn their skill sets, go to a new company, and they end up, you look at their resume a decade later, and it's these 1 and 2 year stints everywhere where it's like, you probably didn't actually get the full education of the job by doing that. And so you don't skill set.
Right. I think, like, to me, and it's not that, oh, they people moved around. It's like, did you actually see something grow to fruition, right? Did you go through the ups and downs? Did you go somewhere and make mistakes that you can actually learn from, right? Like, to me, that's the arc of, I want to see that you had highs and that you had lows. We all learn best from our lows. And so to me, that's what you want to, be able to talk to someone about, like, what was the best part? What was the worst part? What was your worst day? And, you know, and I think that's, to me, like, you stair step it up and you look back in 8 years and you're like, okay, I'm now a VP, but how did I get to where I am? Right? Like, is this what I actually wanted, or did I chase incremental growth rather than sticking it out and really shooting for huge growth opportunities?
Totally agree. Well, Kevin, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for coming on Hawk Talk.
My pleasure. It was fun.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Hawk Talk. To ensure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. If you're listening in Apple Podcasts, we'd love for you to give us a quick rating for the show. Just tap the number of stars you think this podcast deserves. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.